Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now!
President Bush, number 28, said, "The world is safer today because our coalition ended a regime that cultivated ties to terror while it built weapons of mass destruction." Well, you know, his speechwriters and his minders and trainers know very well that every word there was an outrageous lie, but why should it matter? If you repeat it loudly enough, it'll become the truth.
Today, Noam Chomsky on hegemony or survival. America's quest for global dominance. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations General Assembly yesterday approved a resolution demanding Israel stop building the massive 150-mile wall through Palestinian villages in the West Bank. The vote was 144-4. The only countries voting against the measure were the United States, Israel, the Marshall Islands, and Micronesia. 12 nations abstained. Following yesterday's vote, Israel vowed construction of the barrier would continue. 17 Democratic senators joined Republicans yesterday to pass a new law banning some forms of abortion. This marks the first time since Roe v. Wade that Congress has barred specific types of abortion. Opponents of abortion have long described the practice banned as partial birth abortions, but pro-choice groups say the bill is deliberately vague and bans often use safe and common procedures. 3 years ago, the Supreme Court found a similar ban in Nebraska unconstitutional because the bill was written so vaguely. Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa, who voted against the bill, said, quote, "Congress has turned its back on America's women, their right to privacy, the right to choose. America's women," he said, "are now second-class citizens." Iran yesterday pledged to fully cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency by temporarily halting the enrichment and reprocessing of uranium and by allowing in international inspectors. Iran reached the agreement with foreign ministers from Britain, France, and Germany. In Iraq, The Guardian is reporting the U.S. and Iraqi officials are preparing an arrest warrant for the Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, who they charge was involved in the April murder of a rival Shia cleric. Sadr has been one of the most vocal opponents of the U.S.-led occupation. Last week, he announced the formation of a rival government to the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council. Observers in Iraq predict there will be massive resistance if Sadr is arrested. In other Iraq news, defense officials announced plans yesterday to rotate 30,000 more reservists in Iraq. U.S. officials said yesterday they now believe Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of the September 11th attacks, personally played a role in the killing of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl, who was murdered in Pakistan. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld announced the Pentagon is launching an investigation into public statements made by Lieutenant General William Boykin that cast the so-called war on terror in terms of a holy war. Boykin once said the U.S. is battling a, quote, spiritual enemy named Satan. On Friday, Boykin insisted he was not, quote, anti-Islam, and said his remarks had been misconstrued or taken out of context. And this news, a week after a rare protest backed by Saudi dissidents was put down by police in Riyadh. The London-based Islamist opposition group is promising a new challenge by calling on supporters to take to the streets tomorrow in several cities. A new report by Human Rights Watch has determined that 1 in 6 U.S. prisoners suffers from mental illness. The group estimates the nation's prisons hold 3 times as many mentally ill men and women as do the nation's mental hospitals. In Ecuador, a trial has begun where 30,000 Ecuadorians are suing Chevron Texaco for $1 billion for polluting the nation's rainforests and water resources. Chevron Texaco, which later merged with Chevron, is accused of dumping more than 18 billion gallons of toxic materials into unlined pits in Amazon rivers from 1972 to 1992. Former U.S. President George Bush is retiring as senior advisor to the Carlyle Group. The Financial Times reported Carlyle offered no explanation for Bush's retirement other than his age and his desire to move on to other endeavors. Bush was one of many former top officials employed by the secretive private equity firm which invests in defense firms. Others include former British Prime Minister John Major, former U.S. Secretary of State James Baker, and former Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci. George W. Bush also once served on the board of a Carlyle-owned company. Ties between the Bush family and Carlyle become a growing political liability for President Bush, in part because Osama bin Laden's family was major investors in Carlyle up until shortly after the September 11th attacks. And anti-war protesters from across the country are planning to march in Washington and San Francisco this weekend to oppose the U.S. occupation in Iraq. The demonstrations are also timed to coincide with the second anniversary of the passing of the USA Patriot Act. Meanwhile, in Massachusetts, a judge yesterday ruled in favor of 11 anti-war protesters who were arrested for trespassing, committing civil disobedience outside the federal building in Springfield, Massachusetts. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn to Noam Chomsky, Institute Professor of Linguistics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His latest book, Hegemony or Survival? America's Quest for Global Dominance. He spoke at Illinois State University on October 7th. This is Professor Noam Chomsky.
Let's start with about a year ago, September 2002, in the normal course of political life as academic life. September is usually an incipient month, a thing when important things begin to happen. And September 2002 was unusual in this respect. There were three very significant events closely related. One was the declaration of the National Security Strategy on September 17th. It announced very clearly and explicitly that the United States, at least this administration, intends to dominate the world permanently, if necessary, through the use of force. That's the one dimension in which the United States reigns completely supreme, probably by now outspends the rest of the world combined or close to it in military expenditures, and is far ahead in developing advanced and extremely dangerous technology. And it also announced that it will eliminate any potential challenge to that rule. So it's to be permanent hegemony, permanent domination. That was the first event. That's not without precedent. In fact, there are quite interesting precedents. No time to go into them unless you want to later. But this was unusual, and it was correct for the reaction to be as extreme as it was, including the foreign policy elite here. The second associated event was that in September the war drums began to beat loudly about the planned invasion of Iraq. Early September, the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, warned that the next evidence we're likely to have about Saddam Hussein will be a mushroom cloud, presumably over New York. No matter how much everyone else may have hated him, outside the United States, no one feared him, including his neighbors who'd been trying to reintegrate Iraq back into the region. who despised him, including the countries he invaded, but didn't fear him. That was unique to the United States, beginning last September. So first there's going to be a mushroom cloud, and then the propaganda campaign began very loud. The invasion of Iraq that was planned was understood to be what's sometimes called an exemplary action. That is, it's an action intended to demonstrate dramatically that the doctrine that had been announced is intended seriously. It's not enough to just promulgate a doctrine if you want people to take you seriously. You have to do something to show that you mean it. And the invasion of Iraq was understood correctly to be a test case, a demonstration case of the doctrine that the U.S. Government arrogates to itself the right to attack any country it wants without credible pretext and without any international authorization. In fact, the national security strategy is, as commentators quickly pointed out, doesn't even mention international law and the United Nations Charter. In fact, the Bush administration proceeded to make it very clear to the Security Council of the United Nations that they had two choices. They could be relevant, that was the term that was used, by authorizing the United States to use force as it wished, or they could be a debating society, as Colin Powell, the administration moderate, pointed out. Powell was also delegated to address the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, the following January. This is, you know what that is, that's the group that the business press, only semi-ironically, calls the masters of the universe, the people who own the world, the corporate executives who are spending $30,000 for the privilege of attending, and other great and important figures. The mood in Davos was completely different than any of the earlier meetings. It was very angry. The top issue was Iraq. They were strongly opposed to it, just like the rest of the world. Powell faced a very hostile audience, and they were not eager to accept his message, which was, as he put it, that the United States has the sovereign right to use military force. When we feel strongly about something, we will lead, even if nobody else is following. We'll do it because we have the power to do it, and if you don't like it, too bad. The further comments for the administration, from the administration to the Security Council and others, were, we're not going to ask for any authorization from you. You can catch up, is the term that was used, and authorize us to do what we are going to do anyway, or you're irrelevant. That was reiterated very brazenly at the Azores summit, the Bush-Blair summit, right a couple of days before the actual invasion. They met at a military base on the Azores so they wouldn't have to face mass popular opposition, which would have happened anywhere else. And they issued an ultimatum, not to Iraq, but to the United Nations. The ultimatum was, give us your stamp of approval for what we're going to do anyway, or else just go off and be a debating society. They also made it clear that it didn't matter whether Saddam Hussein and his cohort stayed in Iraq or not. As Bush announced, even if the Saddam and his family and associates leave, we're going to invade anyway, because the goal is for us to control Iraq. That's my words, not his. The rest is his words. All very clear and explicit. Can't miss it. And it wasn't missed. I'll come back to that. The third event, before I come back to it, in September, closely related, is that the congressional election campaign opened, the midterm election campaign. The main sort of campaign advisor for the Republican Party, Karl Rove, one of the most important people in Washington. He had already, the preceding summer of 2002, he had instructed party activists that in going into the electoral campaign, they're going to have to emphasize national security issues. They cannot expect to enter a political confrontation with if economic and social policies are prominent on the agenda, because their policies are extremely unpopular, which is not surprising, since they are designed to be extremely harmful to the general population, and people know that, and also to future generations. And you can't go into a political campaign with that kind of a platform. So therefore, it had to be national security issues, on the assumption that people would shift their priorities and vote for those who were going to protect them from imminent destruction. Well, for the elections, it barely worked, by a few tens of thousands of votes, in fact, but enough to allow them a bare hold on political power. The voters' preferences at the polls remained, as exit polls revealed, remained the same, didn't change, but priorities shifted. And enough people huddled under the umbrella of power and fear of the demonic enemy so that they could maintain control, barely. Well, that illustrates one of the dilemmas of dominance that I had in mind. One problem is, how do you control the domestic population? The great beast, as Alexander Hamilton called the people. They're always a problem. The beast is always getting out of control. And one of the main problems of governance, I'm sure you study this in all your political science courses, is how do you keep the great beast in a cage? That's particularly difficult when you're dedicated passionately to carrying out policies that are, in fact, going to be very harmful to the mass of the population and to future generations, then it's difficult. And only one effective way has ever been discovered by the people in office now or anyone else under those conditions, and that is inspire fear. If you can do that, maybe you can get away with it. And for the people in office now, it's second nature. It's important to remember this. It's kind of striking that it hasn't been discussed extensively, but if you think for a minute, the people, the present incumbents in Washington, are almost entirely recycled from the Reagan and first Bush administration, in fact, from their more reactionary sectors, or else their immediate two T's. You know, it's essentially that administration. And they're following pretty much the same script as the first 12 years they had in political power, in both domestically and internationally. And you can learn a lot about what they're doing by just paying attention to what happened in those 12 years. They were, in fact, pursuing policies that were highly unpopular. Reagan's policies were strongly opposed by the population, but they did keep voting for him, mainly out of fear. They continually pressed the panic button every year or two. I'll come back to that. Reagan, in fact, ended up in 1992 being the most unpopular living U.S. president, next to Nixon, ranked slightly above Nixon, well below Carter and even below the almost forgotten Ford. But they did manage to hang on for 12 years, and they're following essentially the same script. Well, except with much more arrogance and commitment and optimism, feeling that they can do things that they couldn't get away with then for various reasons.
You're listening to Professor Noam Chomsky. He is speaking at Illinois State University. He is author of Hegemony or Survival: America's Quest for Global Dominance. Back with Professor Chomsky in a minute.
Fuck la terre, si je meurs, voici mon testament. Déposer des cendres dans la bouche de tous nos opposants. Viré à coups de front, clique les faux qui viennent se recueillir. Je veux des fleurs et des gosses, que ma mort serve leur avenir. Peut-être comprendront-ils le sens du sacrifice, la différence entre les valeurs et puis l'artifice. Je sais qui pleurera et pourquoi. Vous êtes les bienvenus, il n'y aura pas de parvenus, juste des gens de la rue. La presse people n'aura que des smicards et des sans-papiers. Costumes mal taillés, même si les mecs voulaient bien s'habiller. CJ, Noël, Lid d'Arabe, initial M. Si un petit qui a voulu que la vie d'autrui soit comme une poésie. Et surtout, va pas croire qu'il y aura 10 000 filles. Je dis ça pour ma famille, je n'étais pas parti en vrille. On me jette de la terre, on dépose quelques fleurs. Seul, sous son sol pleureur, solar pleure. Plonger. C'est ceux qui sont déjà partis que je m'en vais retrouver. Ne vous inquiétez pas, non, je pars pour le paradis. Pas pour paradis, mais professer la septième prophétie.
And you are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we return to the speech of Noam Chomsky. He gave it October 7th at Illinois State University, author of Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance. Noam Chomsky.
Well, let's go back to the other two major events of September. The national security strategy and the invasion of Iraq. It was understood that this is to be the first, as the New York Times put it, after the war, though it was obvious before, that this was to be the first test of the national security strategy, not the last. The invasion of Iraq, they pointed out, is the petri dish for an experiment in preemptive attack. The term And that was understood around the world. There was huge protest around the world, in the United States too, completely without any historical precedent. And it wasn't just over the invasion of Iraq. That was the same in Davos. It's the same in the foreign policy elite here. It was about the. It was partly that, but more because of the general strategy of which Iraq is to be an exemplary action. It's supposed to create a new norm in international relations, which only those with the guns can implement, of course. And it struck plenty of fear in the world. That's mainly what the protest was about. Well, the phrase that the Times used, preemptive strike, is preemptive attack, is conventional, but completely wrong. Preemptive war has a meaning in international law. It's kind of on the border of legality, if you think about the UN Charter. It authorizes the use of force under one condition, two conditions, either the Security Council calls for it or in self-defense against armed attack until the Security Council has a chance to act. And that has a sort of a fringe of judgment. So, for example, if, say, Russian bombers were flying across the Atlantic with the obvious intent of bombing the United States, it would be legitimate under it would be interpreted as legitimate under Article 51 to shoot them down before they bomb, maybe even to attack the base they were coming from. That's a preemptive strike. It's a military action taken against an imminent attack when no other possibility is open and there's no time to notify the Security Council. That's preemptive war. But that's not what's being proposed. Sometimes it's called, more accurately, preventive war or anticipatory self-defense. Well, that's at least not completely wrong, but it's also mostly wrong. There's nothing that has to be prevented, and there's no self-defense involved. The prevention is against an imagined or invented threat. There was no threat of attack from Iraq. That was farcical. So what's called for is not even preventive war, as the more cautious commentators point out, or anticipatory self-defense. In fact, it's just straight, outright aggression. What was called the supreme crime at Nuremberg, the most serious of all crimes. That's what the doctrine announces. We have the right to carry out the supreme crime of Nuremberg, and we'll count on international lawyers and respectable intellectuals to pretty it up and make it look like something else. But essentially, that's what it comes down to, and that's the way it was understood. I was understood here, too, by people who care about the country. So the most extreme condemnation of the war that I came across was right from the middle of the mainstream. When the U.S. bombed, when the bombing began, Arthur Schlesinger, very respectable American senior American historian, highly respected, one of Kennedy's advisors, had an article in which he said that the bombing of Iraq resembles the actions of Imperial Japan at Pearl Harbor on a date which the president at the time said a date that will live in infamy. And he said President Roosevelt was correct. It's a date that will live in infamy, except that now it's Americans who live in infamy. And the world knows it, and that's the reason why the sympathy and solidarity with the United States that was evident after 9/11 has turned into a wave of revulsion and fear and often hatred, which is horrible in itself and also an extreme danger. Well, he was not alone. The national security strategy aroused many shudders worldwide. That included the foreign policy elite at home. Right away, within weeks, the main establishment journal, Foreign Affairs, of the Council on Foreign Relations, ran an article by a well-known international relations scholar in which he warned that the imperial grand strategy, as he called it, posed great dangers to the world and to the population of the United States. The United States was declaring itself, he said, to be a revisionist state that is tearing to shreds the framework of international law and institutions, and the effect of that is, and hoping, expecting to be able to permanently dominate the world by force, but it's, he said, not going to work, aside from being wrong. It's going to lead to efforts on the part of potential victims to counter it. They're not going to sit there and wait to be destroyed. They can't compete with the United States in military force. Nobody can. But there are weapons of the weak, two primarily. One is weapons of mass destruction, which by now are becoming weapons of the weak. And the other is terror. He and many other foreign policy analysts and intelligence agencies pointed out that the strategy is essentially calling for proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and increase in terror, and it, hence a great danger to the world altogether, but to the United States in particular. The war in Iraq was understood exactly the same way. The U.S. and British intelligence agencies, the British ones have just been exposed in the Hutton inquiry in London, but there were enough leaks before, both the British and the U.S. intelligence agencies and other intelligence agencies, and plenty of independent analysts, just about anyone you pick, predicted that one likely consequence of the Iraq invasion would be proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and terror. Many commentators have pointed out that it's pretty likely that the Iranian and North Korean actions, since are a response to the threat of the national security strategy and its implementation, and are turning to the weapons that are available to them, weapons of mass destruction. The U.S. indeed made that very clear. It was a very clear and ugly lesson taught to the world last winter. North Korea is a far more vicious and ugly and dangerous state than Iraq, bad as Saddam Hussein was. But the U.S. wasn't going to attack North Korea. It was going to attack Iraq as the exemplary action. I mean, in part, that's because Iraq's just a lot more important, you know, as right in the center of the oil-producing region. But in part, it's because Iraq was understood to be completely defenseless. And if you have any brains, you don't attack anybody who can defend themselves. That's stupid. You want to attack somebody who's completely defenseless, and Iraq was known to be completely defenseless. That's why nobody was afraid of it, much as they might have hated it. North Korea, on the other hand, had a deterrent. The deterrent was not nuclear weapons. it was conventional weapons, massed artillery on the DMZ, the border to South Korea, extensive massed artillery aimed at the capital, Seoul, South Korea, and at the U.S. troops in the south. And unless the Pentagon can figure out a way to get rid of that with, precision weapons or something or other, that's a deterrent to a U.S. attack. In fact, U.S. troops have since been withdrawn from the DMZ, and that's caused plenty of concern in both South and North Korea and the region, suggesting a very cynical strategy. You can figure it out. What the U.S. was telling the world is, if you don't want us to attack you and destroy you, you better have some kind of deterrent. And for most of the world, that's going to mean weapons of mass destruction and terror. Result of the war, as far as we know, verified that near universal prediction of intelligence agencies and analysts. It's been pointed out since that, just to quote a few, that the Iraq war was a huge setback for the war on terror, led to a sharp recruitment, sharp spike in recruitment for al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. And in fact, Iraq itself was turned into a haven for terrorists for the first time. It wasn't before, but now it is. That was expected, and that's another dilemma of dominance. You have to control the great beast at home, and while violence is an effective device and may intimidate many people and countries, it's likely to incite others, to incite them to revenge or simply to find means of deterrence. And since no one can think of competing with the United States in military power, that leaves the weapons of the weak, weapons of mass destruction, and terror. And those may sooner or later be united. That's been predicted for years with contemporary technology. It's not that hard for terrorist groups with a low level of financing and sophistication to gain access to even nuclear weapons, small nuclear weapons, and the chances of the possibilities of smuggling them into the United States are overwhelming. If you're interested in having a sleepless night, you can read some of the high-level studies that have been coming out for the past 6 or 7 years, well before 9/11, but increasingly, which are virtually cookbooks for terrorists. I mean, they're the kind of things that I suspect we could do if we wanted to, impossible to stop for all kind of reasons. The Hart-Rudman report, which came out about a year ago, Gary Hart and Warren Rudman, two former senators, a high-level study threats of terror. It gives one of many such examples. So yeah, sooner or later, weapons of mass destruction and terror will be united, and the consequences could be quite horrific. All of that is the likely consequence, predicted and so far happening, of the security strategy and the test case, the dramatic test case to illustrate it. Well, administration planners know all of this as well as everyone else. I mean, they're intelligent, literate. They read the same intelligence reports everyone else does. So they know, yes, that the policies they're carrying out are increasing the threat to the security of the American people and the world and, of course, future generations. And they don't want that. They don't want that outcome. It just doesn't matter very much. If you look at the ranking of priorities, it just doesn't rank very high. Yeah, likely to could happen, but other things are just more important. The things that are more important are establishing global hegemony and carrying out the highly regressive domestic policies of trying to roll back the New Deal and the progressive legislation of the past century, in fact, and creating a very different kind of domestic society, one that most of the public passionately opposes but may accept under the threat of destruction, manufactured and some increasingly real. Well, this again gets back to the first dilemma, How do you control the domestic public, the great beast? In particular, the problem now is winning the 2004 election. Remember that they have a very narrow hold on political power. You all know that. The 2000 election was disputed. The 2002 election was barely managed to sneak through. And now we're up to 2004. And what do we do with that? Well, go back to last May. On the 1st of May, you remember, there was a carefully staged extravaganza which elicited ridicule and fear throughout the world, but was played pretty seriously here when the president landed on the Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier wearing combat gear and, you know, posing and so on and so forth. It was pretty frightening for the world. Here, you know, sort of, let us say, played pretty straight. He gave a victory speech. We've won a victory over in Iraq. The front page story in the New York Times used a phrase that I'll come back to. It's important. They said it was a powerful Reagan-esque finale to the war in Iraq. We'll come back to that. More astute observers pointed out that the extravaganza was the opening of the 2004 election campaign, which must be built on national security themes. That's the Wall Street Journal. Karl Rove, same guy, announced right away that the 2004 election is the main theme is going to have to be what he called the Battle of Iraq, and he emphasized battle. The Battle of Iraq, not the war. It's an episode in the war on terror, which must continue. And in fact, if you look at the president's declaration on the Abraham Lincoln, he said we have won a victory in the war on terror by removing an ally of Al-Qaeda. Notice that it's immaterial that there is not the slightest evidence of any connection between Saddam Hussein and his bitter enemy, Osama bin Laden, and the idea of a connection is dismissed by every competent authority, including the intelligence agencies, but it doesn't matter. It's a higher truth, and all you have to do is repeat it loudly enough and often enough. Facts are irrelevant. In particular, the specific fact, again, I mean, they didn't invent this formula. It's not pleasant to think about the antecedents, but they're there. It's also irrelevant specifically that there is actually a connection between the war on terror and the invasion of Iraq, namely the invasion increased threat of terror, exactly as predicted. But it just doesn't make any difference, and it continues.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky speaking at Illinois State University on October 7th. Noam Chomsky's latest book is Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance. You can get more information at our website at democracynow.org. We'll return to the speech in a minute.
You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color.
Gil Scott Heron. The revolution will not be televised. That was before. He wrote that before Democracy Now! went on TV. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to the speech of Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, author of many books, his latest is Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance. Noam Chomsky speaking at Illinois State University.
A week or so ago, in his weekly presidential radio address, President Bush, September 28th, said, "The world is safer today because our coalition ended a regime that cultivated ties to terror while it built weapons of mass destruction." Well, you know, his speechwriters and his minders and trainers know very well that every word there was an outrageous lie, but why should it matter? If you repeat it loudly enough, it'll become the truth. Well, how can Karl Rove hope to get away with it? Well, just have a look back at what just happened in September 2002, the last election campaign. That, as I said, was the beginning of an onslaught of government media propaganda, which had a very substantial effect. By the end of the month, by the end of September, about 60% of the population regarded Iraq as a serious threat to the security of the United States. And remember, the United States is alone in the world in this respect. I mean, in Kuwait and Iran, which Saddam invaded, they'd be delighted to tear him limb from limb, but they're not afraid of him. And they're not afraid of him because they know exactly what U.S. intelligence and everyone else knows. Iraq was the weakest country in the region. It had been devastated by the U.S. sanctions, which are called U.N. sanctions, but if it wasn't for U.S. pressure, they wouldn't exist. They wiped out the population. They happened to strengthen the tyrant, but devastated the economy. The country was virtually disarmed. It was under total surveillance. Its military budget was about a third that of Kuwait, which has 10% of its population, and far below the other states in the region, including, of course, the regional superpower, which we're not allowed to talk about because it's an offshore U.S. military base. But outside the United States, everyone knows that there is one country in the region that has extensive weapons of mass destruction and has military forces which, according to its own analysts, are more technically advanced and more powerful than those of any NATO country outside the United States. Unmentionable here, but known everywhere else. And Iraq isn't even in the League of Kuwait, let alone anything like that. So it wasn't certainly not a threat, but by the end of September, as a result of a propaganda campaign of quite impressive character, government campaign transmitted uncritically by the media, about 60% of the population believed that there was a threat. Pretty soon after that, the proportion of the population that believed that Iraq was involved in 9/11, maybe responsible for it, went up to 50% higher, depended on how you asked the question, and also the belief that Iraq was, had interrelations with Al-Qaeda and other gross misperceptions, which are rejected by every intelligence agency, including the U.S. But it did work domestically, not anywhere else. The media behavior was, let me quote a non-controversial source, the very respectable Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. The editor, Linda Rothstein, wrote recently that the charges dangled in front of the media failed the laugh test, but the more ridiculous they were, the more the media strove to make wholehearted swallowing of them a test of patriotism. And it's pretty accurate, and it sort of worked only domestically, and not only in part, because it was part of the population. The rest of the population was overwhelmingly opposed to the war at a level that literally has no precedent. But it worked enough to sneak by the election and to build up a base of support for the war. And not surprisingly, a belief in these fantasies was highly correlated with support for the war, as you'd expect. If you believe those things, war sounds right. Well, that's significant. Congress in October, right after the propaganda campaign began, passed a resolution authorizing the government to resort to force to defend the United States against the continuing threat of Iraq. Again, remember, the United States is the only country that was under that threat, but Congress passed it. The media and commentators and the intellectual world were silent about the fact that, I presume they were aware of, that the congressional resolution was a copy. They're still following the script. In 1985, President Reagan declared a national emergency in the United States because of, I'm quoting, the unusual and extraordinary threat to the security of the United States posed by the government of Nicaragua, which was 2 days' driving time from Harlingen, Texas. So we had to quake in fear before that. And notice that that's much more severe than Iraq. That was an unusual and extraordinary threat. In fact, Reagan went on to a press conference where he said, you know, I know the enormous odds against me, but I remember a man named Churchill, and he stood up against terrific odds, fought Hitler, and I'm not going to give up, never, 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 despite the hordes of Nicaraguans who are invading us and about to conquer us. And that passed the laugh test in the United States. If you check back, just report it. And yeah, people were afraid. The rest of the world couldn't believe it, you know. But it happened. That's another reason why they expect that they can do it again. It helps explain the confidence. And it wasn't the only case. I mean, through the 1980s, year after year, there was one or another threat of that nature. Libyan hitmen were wandering the streets of Washington about to assassinate our leader, who was holed up in the White House, you know, surrounded by tanks. The Russians were going to build an air base in the nutmeg capital of the world, Grenada, if they could find it on a map, and they were going to bomb us. That brings us back to the New York Times phrase, powerful Reagan-esque finale. Now, what are they referring to? Well, they know what they're referring to. They're referring to Reagan's speech after the brave cowboy barely saved us from destruction from the Grenadians by sending 6,000 special forces who were able to overcome a couple of dozen middle-aged construction workers. And incidentally won 8,000 medals for it. But then there was a speech saying we're standing tall. That's the powerful Reagan-esque finale that the front page of the New York Times is referring to. Maybe the reporter's being ironic, I don't know. But what gets to the public is just the message, not what's in the person's mind. And the message is, yeah, we're in constant danger. After Grenada, it was Libya again, and after that it was domestic threats. George Bush the First won his election by just straight pulling a race card. Willie Horton, the black rapist, is going to come after you unless you put me in. Crime in the United States is like other industrial countries, but fear of crime is off the spectrum. Same with drugs. Drugs, yeah, problem. Other countries, about the same as here. But fear of drugs is far higher here, and it's constantly manipulated by unscrupulous politicians and obedient media, and you get continual hysteria about drugs and, you know, Nicaraguans on the march and Grenadians and the rest. So there's a reason for the confidence. And remember that they were able to hold power for 12 years, even over the fact that most of the population was considerably harmed by the domestic policies and opposed them. But they stayed in office, and now they are much more confident. Well, there's quite a lot at stake for them. It's not just a matter of narrow political gain. What's at stake is world domination by force, and also control of the major energy resources in the world, which is not a small thing. The hope is, surely, that Iraq will end up being some kind of client state, you know, call it a democracy or something like that, but some sort of client state, what the British used in their day used to call an Arab facade, behind which the British would effectively rule. The U.S. will presumably end up with military bases right in the heart of the oil-producing region for the first time, reliable military bases. That region is of extreme importance. I mean, back in 1945, the Gulf region was recognized by the State Department to be what they called a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the great material prizes of world history. And ever since then, it's been a leading feature in U.S. policy, not surprisingly, to maintain control over it, not access to the oil. If the U.S. was running on renewable energy, you'd still need to control it. It's a huge source of profit, helps fuel the U.S. economy in many ways, and it's a tremendous lever of world control. You control that, you've got powerful controls over others, and there are others know it. That's why they seek energy independence somehow. The U.S. intelligence projections are that it's going to be about two-thirds of the energy reserves of the world in the coming several decades. They also predict that the U.S. itself is not going to rely on it particularly. The U.S., they expect, will rely on more reliable Atlantic Basin sources like the Western Hemisphere and, you know, the Andes, Canada, West Africa, not so dangerous, but you got to control it, because it's a lever of world control and a source of enormous material wealth. Well, that's important. The other aspect of what's important is the domestic policies. The government is just completely redoing what they did the first time around, 20 years ago, but now in a much more extreme form. They're trying to drive the country into what economists call a fiscal train wreck. The purpose is, to use Reaganite terminology, to starve the beast. That was David Stockman's phrase, the Reagan's budget director. The way we can destroy social programs. You can't get up and run for office and say, I'm going to get rid of Social Security and Medicare and schools and so on and so forth. But what you can do is say, well, we got this huge deficit, you know, tremendous debt, you know. In fact, they're now estimating, the government's own economists are now estimating they're going to have $44 trillion of unpayable bills. And that's great, because that's a fiscal train wreck, and we'll starve the beast. The beast being anything in the government that functions for the benefit of the population. They want a powerful state. In fact, they've increased federal spending radically. It's the biggest increase in federal spending since the first time they were in office 20 years ago. So it's got to be a very powerful state, but oriented toward the needs of the rich and the powerful, not the rest of us. They'll survive somehow. Huge, you know, unpayable debts are fine. That's the way you starve the beast. Massive tax cuts for the rich, a huge increase in federal spending. So it's kind of the Reagan policies, but much more extreme, just like the international ones are similar, but more extreme. And the only method, again, is press the panic button. Well, there are other dilemmas of dominance, and they're worth paying some attention to. One of the most spectacular achievements of the propaganda system, the doctrinal system, in the past year, and I don't mean just the media, I mean the journals of opinion, you know, the intellectuals, the academic world, and so on, the whole matrix of doctrinal management, of which the media are the most obvious. But I think one of the most extraordinary achievements was to be able to continue to proclaim that we, the United States, is pursuing, maybe badly, but is pursuing the noble vision of democratizing the Middle East. That, for that not to pass the laugh test, is pretty remarkable, because all of that was going on in the midst of a display of hatred and contempt for democracy, which has absolutely no historical precedent that I can think of. I can't even think of anything that comes close. Try and think of it. Just remember what was going on these past year. So take, for example, the distinction that was drawn between old Europe and new Europe. And what was the distinction? Well, there was a criterion, very clear criterion. Old Europe, the bad guys, France and Germany, in old Europe, which was reviled and denounced, the governments were taking the same position as the overwhelming majority of the population. They were the bad guys. New Europe, the good guys, like Berlusconi in Italy and Aznar in Spain, they were overruling an even larger majority of the population. There was more opposition to the war in Spain and Italy than there was in France and Germany. But people in power were willing to take their orders from Crawford, Texas. So they were the marvelous New Europe. The wonderful guys had real democratic credentials. The most dramatic case of this, perhaps, was Turkey. To everybody's surprise, mine too, the Turkish government taught the United States a lesson in democracy, which caused fury here. 95% of the population opposed the war. Like everyone else in the region, they hated Saddam Hussein, but they didn't fear him. They didn't see any reason for the war and were afraid of its consequences. So you got 95% opposition, and to everyone's amazement, the government went along with 95% of the population, despite the fact that they were under terrific threats from the United States not to do that. Well, that caused outrage here. The Turkish government was denounced as not having democratic credentials. Paul Wolfowitz went so far as to condemn the Turkish military for failing to intervene to force the government to follow U.S. orders. And he told them, you're going to have to apologize to us for that and make it clear that you're going to help the United States. Then you'll have democratic credentials. Particularly interesting in Wolfowitz's case because he comes out of central casting as the visionary who's leading the way to democratize the Middle East. Now, all of this goes on in parallel, and nobody laughs, you know? Nobody comments on it. I mean, it's as if it's an intellectual culture of zombies, you know? I mean, it's hard to imagine how this can take place. And people looking at it from the outside are having trouble imagining. But that's us. We're right at the heart of it. You know, we're not talking about the people watching Rush Limbaugh or something. We're talking about the educated elites, okay? Us, smart guys. That's worth some reflection, a lot of reflection, I think, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Bloomington, Illinois, and everywhere else. But it's not happening, and that's high degree of discipline. Very high degree of discipline and dangers.
Professor Noam Chomsky, giving a speech at Illinois State University on October 7th. Professor Chomsky is university professor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, master linguist, and author of dozens of books. His latest is called Hegemony or Survival: America's Quest for Global Dominance. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to go to our website, democracynow.org, you can sign up there for our Daily Digest, get more information. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke and Sharif Abdelkaddous and Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, and Pervez Sharma. Special thanks to Simba Russo and John Randolph, Uri Galed, Johnny Sender, Chris Zucker. Our website again, democracynow.org. Mike DeFilippo and Rich Kim are engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. To design, build, sell, and store, and